Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Thursday, April 4th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Teresa Whitaker and Dorothy Hockenberg. And here's our first story. USPS moves ahead with changes. Mail distribution operations to move from Milan to Des Moines. This is by Grace Kennicott. Mail distribution in the Quad Cities will move out of town. A document Tuesday said United States Postal Service is moving ahead with the decision to drop the distribution center in Milan and move it to Des Moines. The Milan center will continue to be open and used as a processing center rather than both a distribution and processing center. The Dispatch Argus Quad City Times previously reported that USPS has been considering changes to the Milan facility as part of the $40 billion Delivering for America plan to upgrade and improve the mail process. In the April documents, it shows that the change is expected to save the facility between $970,000 and $1.3 million a year. The documents say no career layoffs in the local workforce are anticipated, though USPS is planning to transfer positions. This go-forward plan for the Quad Cities facility will help USPS achieve the core goals of our Delivering for America plan, financial sustainability for our organization, and improved service reliability for our customers, the conclusion of the document said. The bulk of the savings are expected to come from maintenance operations, the USPS document said, at around $600,000 to $800,000 a year. 10 maintenance positions, including 2 management positions, will be lost from the Milan facility. The move is expected to add $50,000 to $70,000 in transportation costs, but no transportation positions are expected to be lost. The USPS final document states 41 craft employee positions will be lost at the Milan facility, 33 in processing and 8 in maintenance. The Des Moines facility will add 29 processing positions. 3 management positions at the Milan facility also will be lost, 1 in processing and 2 in maintenance. The Des Moines facility will add 1 processing management. USPS said it will work with the unions and management associations in the staffing impacts of the changes and follow the relevant collective bargaining agreements and USPS policies. The USPS also will spend $5 to $10 million on major upgrades and renovations at the Milan facility, including new sorting machines, rehabbing the loading docks, and renovating restrooms and break rooms, stated in the documents. In February, nearly 24 postal workers attended the presentation of the proposed change and spoke out against the change during public comment. Many felt like the USPS was downplaying the fact that employees would be moved out of the facility and were worried about the lack of preparedness the Des Moines facility might face. Postal worker Muriel Weeks was one of the many who questioned if the Des Moines facility would be able to handle Quad City's mail on top of what it already handles daily. The mail is already late coming out of Des Moines. They seem like they are understaffed or overworked, she said. Us adding the burden of our mail to their facility is not going to make mail delivery more efficient. It's going to slow it down. The Milan facility's retail and business mail acceptance will not be impacted by the changes, nor will collection box times change, the USPS document said. Others also brought up that the move to Des Moines seemed to show a lack of efficiency, worried about mail-in ballots during the election, and how some more rural areas already faced delayed time in mail. A customer of more than 7 decades of the USPS, Paul Laird, also spoke during the public comment portion. In the last 35 years alone, he said he has mailed more than 50,000 postcards. I'm known as the postcard guy. I used to be able to mail in the Quad Cities, knowing the Quad Cities recipient would get it the next day, he said. The last 5 or 6 years, I have had to mail them 2 days in advance to make sure they have a chance at getting it.
Okay, Silvis, part of new mental health program by Olivia Allen. Silva School District will pilot a comprehensive new program focused on proactive mental health programming for pre-K through 12 students. The District Comprehensive Approach, DCA, pilot program aims to help participating school districts develop a strategic plan for student mental health and suicide prevention programming. The program is organized through the JED Foundation, JED, and the AASA, the School Superintendent Association. Silvis is one of 15 districts nationwide selected for the pilot. Here, participating school districts will receive a local district strategic plan as a guide for building comprehensive student mental health and suicide prevention programming, along with 2 years of technical assistance from JED experts. The DCA pilot will also provide school staff with new professional learning opportunities. Silvis Superintendent Terry Van De Wiel, who is also an AASA member, said the opportunity to apply for the DCA pilot was too good to pass up. As a school district, a major force for us is making sure we educate the whole child, she said. We believe that if a student's basic needs aren't met, including their mental health needs, that it's going to be hard for them to learn that at high level. The pilot will include a comprehensive needs assessment, Van Wiel said, which will help the district identify its strengths and areas for improvement. The beauty of this is that there are 14 other participating school districts nationwide, and we are going to be able to collaborate with them, she said. They might be doing something new and innovative that we can learn from. On this front, Van De Wiel is thankful to see school districts of varied sizes and communities participating in the DCA pilot. Sometimes my experience has been that smaller districts don't always have the same opportunities as maybe a larger school district would, she said. So I appreciate that a diverse cohort was a priority because our needs are very different. Other pilot participants include Chandler Unified School District in Arizona, Kuspook School District in Aniak, Alaska, and Washington Local Schools in Toledo, Ohio. Regardless, Van De Wiel hopes that the DCA pilot reaps benefits for all participants and said Silva's work with the student mental health could serve as a model for other smaller school districts. Amber Sansabaugh, principal of Northeast Junior High School, thinks the DCA pilot could be especially impactful for students at the junior high level. We have more and more students coming to us with a variety of mental health needs and significant trauma, which obviously impacts every portion of their time here, she said. Another common issue junior high counselors deal with, Sansabaugh said, is conflict resolution, an issue she says social media often exacerbates. While Silva schools already leverage existing mental health supports and community partnerships, she looks forward to the DCA pilot's comprehensive piece. You know, making sure that all of our bases are covered because our needs are continuing to grow from our student population, Sansabaugh said. We just want to make sure there's nobody that slips through the cracks. Tackling the social-emotional needs of students and their families, as the two play hand-in-hand, she said, is a complex task the DCA pilot will likely help Silva school teachers' leaders navigate. So it's exciting to be able to delve into that a little bit more and really try to come up with something outside of the box thinking that we maybe haven't had so far, Sansabaugh said. Regardless, the mental health need is there, and it's not just us. While she's not exactly sure how the DCA program will work for Silvis schools, Van De Wiel looks forward to exploring all sorts of different opportunities to support students' mental health. I don't have a crystal ball, but I do think we may find that we need more social work help. It may be more counseling or something like a school-based health clinic, she said. We're going to be looking at all aspects of a school district, all the way down to what happens in an individual classroom. The inaugural DCA cohort will serve more than 356,000 students from 480 schools across 14 states. Tony Walker, Senior Vice President of Academic Programs at JED, said the organization primarily worked in higher education prior to launching the DCA pilot. Then continued nationwide youth mental health crisis, however, caused JED to shift its focus to the K-12 level. Even in the 10 years leading up to the COVID-19 pandemic, youth rates of depression and suicide ideation were an all-time high. And of course, COVID-19 only exacerbated those statistics, Walker said. We know that K-12 school district leaders are eager for additional help and support. Partnering with the AASA for the program, he said, made sense. They really bring incredible perspective and expertise from the superintendent's level, Walker said. JED really brings that deep mental health content expertise and expertise around building comprehensive systems of support for young people. With JED's expertise on best practices combined with data-driven guidance, he said the DCA program will create a framework to protect the mental health and prevent suicide for millions of students. This work is especially important since some areas lack adequate community-based mental health services, said Ann Levitt, Assistant Executive Director of the AASA Learning Network. So a natural place for us to try and build that capacity is in the schools, she said. That's where children are 5 days a week, 180 days a year. Levitt looks forward to strengthening the capacity of both students and staff to address their own mental wellness. This could mean building new connections between school districts and outside organizations, increasing access to mental health resources, she said. So many times, people are having mental health difficulties but won't ask for help, or they don't know where to go for help, she said. That would be the second core or goal for us as superintendents. We want people to know where to go for help.
Okay. On the front page, we have a picture here of Ray Vrana, chef at Cavort, shaking a dragon fruit daiquiri on Wednesday, January 24th in Davenport. And the article title is What I Love to Do. Davenport chef jumps every hurdle to open restaurant of her own. This is by Gretchen Teske. Every time Rhea Vrana was confronted with a challenge, she found a way to overcome it. And downtown Davenport is all the better for it. The owner and executive chef behind Cavort, the upscale restaurant and bar at 229 Brady Street, started her career a few blocks over, but originally had dreams that reached beyond the Quad Cities. I was very much the person that wanted to know whatever California was, she said. I wanted to go and travel and find a coast or beach or something like that, but I ended up starting to bartend, and I quickly moved into the kitchen. The Davenport-born and raised chef started her career with an education from the Scott Community College Culinary Program. In need of student hours, she began working at the Base Street Chop House in Moline. I learned a ton a little bit quicker with being in the kitchen environment, adding she moved up from prep cook to sous chef within 2 years. It was a great ride, and I loved every second of it. Her next endeavor was at the short-lived downtown Davenport restaurant, Rome, owned by brothers Dylan and Griffin Steele. The restaurant opened in December 2018 on River Drive with a concept of small plates and shareables with no TVs and a focus on the food and environment. The brothers very much had mad love for the Quad Cities and wanted to bring something really cool and unique here because they're big travelers, she said. I fell in love with that idea because the Quad City people deserve something cool. We shouldn't always have to go to Des Moines or Chicago. We can build it right here and never have to leave. When that portion of downtown Davenport severely flooded the following spring, multiple businesses were forced to close. Rome ended up being one of them. I was in love with that place. I had a lot of work to do, but the flood took us out, and every move from there I made out of survival, just trying to stay in the industry, she said. One of her first moves was to team up with fellow chefs to offer a pop-up kitchen at a local brewery with proceeds going to flood relief. It was a massive success, and soon Vrana became the owner of Fat Sacks, a late-night fast food alternative. I was not your boxed, microwaved, or deep-fried stuff. It was really fun takes on fatty items, she said. We had a walk-up window, and it was an indoor food truck concept. The concept kitchen was located inside another downtown Davenport bar and was wildly successful for a while. Then COVID-19 came into the picture. We closed down for a couple of weeks to make sure everyone was healthy and safe, but we needed a plan because things were so crazy at that time, she said. Finally, it got to the point where we were like, here we are again. A disaster has taken us out, so we have to make a move. Takeout foods skyrocketed in popularity, and Vrana took full advantage. The walk-up window stayed busy, and attention to the new concept was great for sales, but came with another downside, not enough room. Vrana said she quickly outgrew the space and once again had to look for another option. That led her to the doors of the Union Arcade building on the corner of Brady and 3rd Streets. Once inside the lobby, elevators take guests upstairs to the 68 apartments that overlook the downtown landscape. On the main floor and just inside the entrance, Vrana turned a former coffee shop and bakery space into an upscale lounge and eatery she named Cavort. We called it Cavort because we didn't want it to be backed into one concept or idea, but for the word to mean jumping and dancing excitedly, that's what we do, she said. Vrana originally opened the restaurant with a former co-worker, but has since become the sole owner. The inside of the restaurant is dressed with bold wallpaper, a wall entirely made of greenery, and neon signs that add a layer of fun to the sophisticated landscape. Dark lighting and jewel-toned furniture and curtains accent the room and create spaces comfortable for both business and casual dinners. Vrana calls her style No Coast Tiki, accented by the pineapple and tiki glassware and Caribbean undertones in the drinks. On the food menu, Vrana made sure her concept hit home with duck wontons and hot crab dip on the bites menu, balanced with salmon, burger, and chicken options on the plates side. One of her favorite menu options is Yucatan pulled pork nachos, which combines bright colors with sweet, salty, crunchy, and creamy flavors. No matter what customers order, Vrana said, there is no feeling like watching her food go out the door. After picking herself up time and time again, she's finally found the place where it all comes together, she said. That alone is worth jumping and dancing excitedly for. It's the highest honor, she said. It is really, truly rewarding. This is the hardest thing I have ever done, but I love every second of it, and that's why I continue to do it. This is more than making money or seizing an opportunity. This is what I love to do.
Okay, Quad City Symphony Orchestra sets season by Gannon Hannevold. Quad City Symphony Orchestra has announced its schedule for the 2024-25 season. The orchestra's 110th season will follow the theme Echoes of Exploration and include shows that are part of their Masterworks, Pops, and Up Close series. The announcement came at an event for donors and subscribers at Me and Billy Wednesday night. We look forward to engaging the entire Quad Cities community with an incredibly diverse lineup, said QCSO Music Director Mark Russell Smith in a release shared Wednesday. The Masterworks series will kick off October 5 and 6 with shows at the Adler Theater and Centennial Hall, respectively. It will recur at the start of each month through April 2025, closing with the always popular Rhapsody in Blue show on April 5 and 6 in 2025. Along the way, there will be a lot to explore in the Masterworks series, QCSO Executive Director Brian Baxter said in an interview with the Quad City Times-Dispatch Argus. In November, the QCSO will have a first-of-its-kind collaboration with Ballet Quad Cities for a performance of Mendelssohn's Midsummer Night's Dream. The whole second half of that show will feature dance with the orchestra on stage, Baxter said. That's not something we typically do, and it'll be a really beautiful partnership there. Masterworks 4 in February 2025 will be a performance of Omar's Journey from the Omar, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 2023. Omar was composed by multi-time Grammy Award winner Rhiannon Giddens, who recently appeared on Beyoncé's new record, Cowboy Carter, and Michael Abels, who has written scores for films like Get Out, Nope, and the forthcoming Star Wars spin-off, The Acolyte. Zeppelin for Riverfront Pops. Alongside the Masterworks schedule, the QCSO will also announce its full lineup for shows for its Pops series, which incorporates movies, popular music, and other pop cultural touchpoints. The Signature Pops event is the yearly Riverfront Pops show, which has attracted thousands of attendees in the past. In previous Riverfront Pops programs, the QCSO has played the music of acts like Fleetwood Mac, The Beach Boys, and Journey. This year, they'll be playing Led Zeppelin. The show will be held on August 17 at LeClaire Park and will include the band's biggest hits like All My Love, Good Times, Bad Times, Dear Maker, and Stairway to Heaven. And it will wrap up with a traditional performance of the 1812 Overture and Stars and Stripes Forever during the fireworks display. Baxter said that Led Zeppelin's music will be a contrast to other classic bands they've incorporated before. We want a group that can have wall-to-wall hits the whole night, because people just love it, and Led Zeppelin, of course, has that, he said. I'd say this one's a little bit heavier rock than some of the recent shows we've done, so that'll be a nice difference. Baxter said they settled on Led Zeppelin after weighing responses to a survey of their audience on which programs they'd like to see. To celebrate the Halloween season, the QCSO will hold a live performance alongside the film Hocus Pocus on October 26 at the Adler Theater. Before Thanksgiving, they'll also continue the tradition of playing alongside a Harry Potter film, with this year's showing being for the seventh movie in the franchise, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 1. The Echoes of Exploration theme will stretch into new territory for the QCSO in May of 2025. With a video game-themed show at the Adler Theater. The program will include composition from games like World of Warcraft, Kingdom Hearts, Final Fantasy, and Skyrim. Baxter said the video gameplay will also play on a screen behind the orchestra, adding that something like this is entirely new for the QCSO. It's like a totally different world from what our orchestra has done, he said. But there's a lot of video game shows out there that orchestras do, and they're extremely popular because there's a lot of gamers. As part of their Up Close series, the QCSO also has shows planned in conjunction with the Rock Island Library and the MLK Center, Baxter said. Tickets for the 2024-25 season open first to QCSO subscribers at 9 a.m. on Thursday. Single tickets open to the public on May 15 at 9 a.m. at the QCSO box office at 327 Brady Street in Davenport. Visit the QCSO website at www.qcso.org to see the full schedule.
Power returns after electrical fire. And we have a picture here, a couple pictures of Mid-American crews working on electrical repairs along Harrison Street Wednesday after an underground electrical fire led to power being turned off for parts of downtown Davenport Tuesday evening. This article is by Cannon Hennevold and Sarah Watson. Power was restored throughout downtown Davenport by Wednesday morning, except one street light, after an underground electrical fire Tuesday afternoon. MidAmerican Energy spokesperson Jeff Greenwood said the company did not yet know what caused the fire, but the blaze affected underground power cables at 3rd and Harrison Streets. Tuesday at about 4:20 p.m., a fire broke out in the underground electric utility vault at that intersection. Smoke billowed from beneath manhole covers, and occasionally flames shot up and loud bangs startled passersby. After the fire started, MidAmerican cut the power to several local circuits to help extinguish the fire, Greenwood said, which left about 5,600 customers without power. Davenport first responders closed Harrison Street downtown, street lights went dark, and several businesses in the downtown closed. Nearly all customers' power was restored by 7:45 p.m., Greenwood said. Shortly before 6 o'clock, after the fire was extinguished, we safely restored all but about 200 customers, Greenwood wrote in an email. Our crews made initial assessments and repairs that enabled us to restore nearly all remaining customers by approximately 7:45 Tuesday night. By 11:20 a.m. Wednesday morning, the one downtown apartment building, still without power, had its electricity restored, Greenwood said, leaving just one streetlight without power. Temporary stop signs were set up at the intersection, like a four-way stop, and two lanes on Harrison Street were closed Wednesday, while MidAmerican crews continued repair work underground. Additional repair efforts are ongoing and will take some time to complete, Greenwood wrote. The power outage closed multiple businesses along downtown's Motor Row on Tuesday night, but several said that with it being a weekday during unexpected snow flurries, the damage wasn't quite as severe. Dan Bush, founder of Bummer City, which owns downtown businesses Analog Arcade, Devon's Complaint Department, and Armored Gardens, said they gave it a half hour without power before closing the doors. I'm glad it happened on a Tuesday and not a Friday, he said. The last picture house's power went out just before the last slate of showings. General Manager Jameson Ritter said the cinema had around 60 ticket holders impacted, and they've worked to coordinate refunds or ticket transfers. Customers were really patient with us last night and really patient with us today as well, understanding that the power outage of kind of out of our hands, he said. We're really thankful. Sean Moeller, show promoter at Raccoon Motel, said that the concert they had booked Tuesday had already been canceled due to an illness with the band. They planned to keep the bar open but ended up closing after the outage. Moeller predicted that it wouldn't affect their business too severely, but felt sympathetic to the many restaurants down the road going dark before peak dinner hours. This is just a freak thing, he said. How could you even come up with the idea that there's going to be a fire in the electric vaults? The fact you saw smoke coming out of the manholes is madness. Bush, too, was surprised at the cause, but optimistic that the outage wouldn't be hard to overcome. Those pesky Ninja Turtles, he joked, later adding, once you've gone through a flood and a pandemic, things like this mean nothing. You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
Going to the obits now. Lynn L. Begun, that is spelled B-E-G-U-H-N, May 19, 1940 to April 2, 2024. Lynn L. Begun, 83, of Davenport, Iowa, passed away peacefully in his sleep on Tuesday, April 2, 2024, at the Senior Star Assisted Living Facility in Davenport. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, April 6th at Rungay Mortuary, Davenport. Visitation will be 12 p.m. until the time of service. Burial will be in Davenport Memorial Park. Memorials may be made to the family to establish a memorial fund in his name. Condolences may be shared at www.rungmortuary.com. Lynn was born May 19, 1940, to Ray and Elma Begun of Davenport. Lynn attended Davenport High School and was part of the last graduating class in 1959. He was united in marriage to Sarah Funk on June 29, 1963, and was married 51 years until her passing in 2014. Lynn was a dedicated worker and was employed by Alcoa in the foil mill for 39 years until his retirement. He also attended Grace United Methodist Church, where he served as an usher and helped with various other duties. He had a close community of lifelong friends. Throughout his life, Lynn, Sandy, and the family traveled the U.S., and Lynn in particular loved his Florida visits. Being a good neighbor was important to Lynn, and he enjoyed hosting the potluck get-togethers for Memorial Day, the 4th of July, and Labor Day. The family would like to extend a heartfelt gratitude and appreciation to Jerry, Marcia, John, Gloria, and Jane, who provided Lynn with amazing support in his last few years. Humorously, Lynn had certain topics he liked to discuss regularly with family, friends, and anyone else who would listen. Some of these would include the weather, new construction sites around the area, his love of hot sauce, and surprisingly, his running of the Bix years ago, to name a few. A couple of highlights toward the end of his life that Lynn commented on was how much he enjoyed spending his last Christmas with John, Andrea, the grandkids, and great-grandchildren in Cedar Rapids. Another was how nice everyone was at Senior Star, and he loved the soup. Survivors include his daughter, Kelly Windham, Davenport, son John, wife Andrea Begun, Cedar Rapids, 8 grandchildren, Sean, husband Morgan, Jessica, husband Bryce, Kim, Caitlin, Dustin, wife Allie, Amanda, Carly, husband Justin, and Zachary, and 5 great-grandchildren, as well as many nieces and nephews. In addition to his wife, he was preceded in death by his parents, brother Jim, sister Patricia, and a very special lifelong friend, Bernie Billman. Wanda Shell Tagg, that is spelled capital T-A-G-U-E. Shelley, preferred name, Tagg, passed away peacefully on Easter Sunday, March 31st. She lived an amazing 98 years and spent her life learning and teaching. Her early years were spent in foster care with an amazing Nana, who recognized her potential and encouraged her in all aspects of her life. Shelley graduated from the University of Dubuque and taught high school English until she and husband Tom started a family. Shelley volunteered for many organizations, including the Girl Scouts, Camp Wyoming, and Eden Valley Nature Center. She also worked part-time at the LeClaire Library. Her love of nature inspired generations of young people and helped all of us be better stewards of the earth. Survivors include her daughter and son-in-law, Trish and Byron Burnett, her son, Tim, 5 grandchildren, and 8 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her husband, 1 grandson, her companion cat, Toby, and her beloved grandcat, Joey. Cremation will take place at Trimble Crematory under the direction of Trimble Funeral Home in Moline. In lieu of services, her family asks that you rejoice in the beauty of nature and spend time with family to honor Shelley's life. Donations may be made to the Humane Society of Scott County or the American Red Cross. Condolences may be shared at TrimbleFuneralHomes.com. Thomas Tom Candler, February 3, 1945 to March 25, 2024. Thomas Tom Candler, 79, of Davenport, passed away at his home on Monday, March 25th, surrounded by his devoted family. Per Tom's wishes, Tom was cremated and insisted on a private family celebration of life, which was held on Thursday, March 28th, at the Rock Island Arsenal with an honor guard presentation to represent his 20 years of loyal service as a major in the United States Army serving in Vietnam. Thomas was born on February 3, 1945, to Robert and Lois McFadden Candler in Santa Monica, California. He proudly served in the U.S. Army for over 20 years. He was united in marriage to Carol Sims Chennings on December 22, 1987, in Davenport. Tom was an avid poker player, enjoying and always looking for that big win. His younger days, he enjoyed a good round of golf, a round of beers with his friends, and sharing stories that always got bigger, longer, and funnier. At one time, he even collected quite a stamp collection, but that soon became not as lucrative. He also loved a good old fat cigar and a glass of port wine. 5 days a week for over 25 years, he would go to the Big Ten Mart on 18th and 53rd and have coffee with the same group of men, Al, Pat, and Steve. And every day they had the solutions to fix this dying, controlling, greedy, corrupt nation, trying desperately. If you would have time to put Tom, Al, Pat, and Steve in charge of our country, trust me, no one would be coming across our borders illegally and getting into things handed to them without working for it. They were all real, true United States Americans who loved our country and hated what it has been reduced to. Tom worked for Pfizer Pharmaceuticals back in the late 70s and 80s before greed struck and was manager of the Eastern United States and Europe, traveling abroad countless times to military hospitals, military bases, and consulting with numerous doctors. He was a very well-respected man and one that will be missed by his many friends and family. May he rest in peace. Left to honor his memories are his wife, Carol, children Christy Candler Phillips and husband Andy Hill of Lighthouse Point, Florida, stepchildren Cammie, husband Andy Wall of Bettendorf, and Brooke, husband Aaron Toma of Durant, grandchildren Riley Phillips, step-grandchildren Annalisa Wall of Grimes, Andrew Wall of Iowa City, Max, Gus, and Louis Toma, all of Durant, his sisters Terry Beach of Des Moines and Temple Candler of Bull City, Arizona. He was preceded in death by his parents, grandparents, and one nephew. Memorial donations may be directed to the family of St. Jude's or Coram Deo Bible Church. Bill Coranda, 71, of Welton, passed away Monday, April 1, at St. Anthony's Hospital in Rockford, Illinois. Visitation will be from 2 until 5 p.m. Sunday, April 7th, at Schultz Funeral Home in DeWitt. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, April 8th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in DeWitt. Burial will follow at Oakview Cemetery in Weldon. Arrangements are in the care of Schultz Funeral Home in DeWitt. Condolences may be expressed at www.schultzfuneralhomes.com.
Roxy A. DeShane of Muscatine was 78 when she passed away on Sunday, March 31st at her home. Funeral services will be at 12 p.m. Wednesday, April 3rd at Estradol Mortuary and Crematory at 1301 4th Street, Orion. Visitation will be at 10 a.m. until services on Wednesday. Burial will be at Glenwood Cemetery, Coal Valley. Memorials may be made to the Orion High School Scholarship Fund, which will benefit a student pursuing agriculture, horticulture, or floriculture. Roxy was born on July 3, 1945, in Wapello, the daughter of C.A. Sandy and Violet Rose. She married Dallas DeShane on September 23, 1995, at the Rock River Croatian Club in Moline. He preceded her in death on May 9, 2017. Roxy had previously worked as a legal and school secretary and also as a real estate agent with Weir Realty. She was also an interior designer owning Raffia Originals. She enjoyed gardening, crafts, decorating, and interior design. She was very creative and was a wonderful hostess. She was an Illinois master gardener and hosted the QC Gourd Festival at her and Dallas's home, fondly known as Whispering Winds Ranch in Orion. Roxy was an avid Hawkeye fan of both the men's and women's basketball teams. Above all, Roxy loves spending time with her family and creating memories. Survivors include her daughter, Jerry Robison, granddaughter, Allie Schellebarger, and their children, Violet, Iris, Winnica, J.J. Schellebarger, granddaughter, Charlotte Robison, granddaughter, Samantha Siha, and their son, Carter, siblings, Eldon Rose, Vicki Reynolds, Warren Rose, Sandra McClanahan, many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her husband, Dallas DeShane, parents, C.A. Sandy and Violet Rose, sister in infancy, Roberta, son-in-law, Tony Robison, grandparents, Cora and Guy Moore, and Anna and Mike Rose. Out of Davenport, Sheila Ray Carrillo. Funeral services for Sheila Ray Carrillo, 71, of Davenport, will be at 11 a.m. Monday at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home, Bentendorf. Burial will follow at Fairmont Cemetery in Davenport. Family will greet friends on Sunday from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the funeral home. Sheila passed away on Tuesday, April 2nd, at Select Specialty Hospital in Davenport, surrounded by her family. Sheila Vance was born on October 22, 1952, at Lutheran Hospital in Moline, Illinois, the daughter of Donald and Betty Lou Johnson Vance. She married Franklin Carrillo on December 6, 1986, in Davenport. Sheila enjoyed crafting and was a member of West Side Assembly of God Church in Davenport. Survivors include her husband, Franklin of Davenport, daughter Tammy Sitter of Bettendorf, grandchildren Brandon Schleiper, Jordan Sitter, Lauren Sitter, Ryan Sitter, great-grandchildren Talon Schleiper, Oakland Mills, sister Jody Ortega of Pleasant Valley, and seven step-siblings. She was preceded in death by her parents, her stepfather Lloyd Marker, and sister Jacqueline Banks. Memorials may be directed to Westside Assembly of God Church in Davenport. And now we'll go to the opinion section.
Another view from Los Angeles Times, although it's the opinion section of the Quad City Times. Bring dials buttons back to new cars. Distracting screens shouldn't run wipers, headlights, and other critical functions. As cars go electric and get more technologically advanced, their interiors are increasingly being built around prominent dashboard touchscreens. Nearly every automaker has been moving controls for windshield wipers, headlights, air conditioning, gear selections, and other basic functions to these centralized touchscreens. It's an industry-wide shift that is most pronounced with the electric vehicles, but not limited to them. Consumers have rightly complained that the screens are more of a pain to use than the intuitive physical buttons, dials, and switches cars have been equipped with for decades. But the trend is not just an issue of consumer preference or convenience. It's a matter of safety, because the time drivers spend tapping through sleek but hard-to-navigate touchscreen menus is time they are taking their eyes off the road. So it's welcome news that an influential auto safety certification body in Europe is working on new standards that would push against car companies' over-reliance on distracting touchscreens. Under new standards, the European New Car Assessment Program plans to introduce in 2026, automakers will have to use separate physical buttons, dials, or levers for critical functions such as turn signals, hazard lights, horns, windshield wipers, and emergency calls to earn the independent organization's top 5-star safety rating. It's about time. Tesla and other manufacturers devote much of their dashboard space to huge center-mounted screens as big as 18.5 inches. The Ford Expedition has an available 15.5 inch screen that replaces an array of audio and climate dials and buttons with touch controls. The Mercedes-Benz EQS features a full-dash hyperscreen that spans nearly the entire width of the vehicle's interior. But not everyone sees it as progress. Customer complaints have forced some car makers, including Volkswagen, to bring back some of the manual buttons. Third-party companies are seeking a ripe market for aftermarket buttons and dials to mount below Tesla's touch screens. The backlash is understandable. The screenification has gone too far. In the name of driver distraction and safety, some functions are so critical to safe operation that they should remain physical and easy to access without screens. We'd like to see U.S. authorities follow suit and adopt their own standards. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, drivers' distraction resulted in at least 3,000 known deaths in 2019, the most recent year for which figures are available. NHTSA is making significant updates to its five-star safety ratings program that could include measures to address drivers' distraction from controls and displays inside vehicles. Drivers have enough to worry about on the roads. They shouldn't have to spend time thinking about how to control their car's most basic functions.
Okay, we have another column here by Jonah Goldberg. RFK Jr. isn't the alternative choice that voters want. American politics is so intensely stupid and nasty that it sometimes seems as if somebody made a series of wishes with a monkey's paw. The dark moral of The Monkey's Paw, a 1902 short story by the English writer W.W. Jacobs that became a pop culture trope, is that you should be careful what you wish for because you just might get it. In 2008, the widespread wish for an African-American president who would usher in a new post-racial politics yielded to an era of heightened obsession with and tensions over race. In 2016, the ancient dream of a capitalist outsider who would run government like a business delivered a man who ran the government like it was the business of promoting and enriching him. In 2020, the notion that a non-military threat could unite a divided country around a common challenge gave way to sharp polarization over the management, treatment, and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. And then there's the dream of the third party or independent candidate who can break the Republican-Democratic duopoly and deliver rational politics and policies unbeholden to special interests and fringe ideologues. The hitch is that white voters and donors love the idea in the abstract. Many recoil in the face of a flesh-and-blood third-party candidate. Organizations such as No Labels and the Libertarian and Green parties rightly highlight voter hunger for an alternative to Donald Trump and President Joe Biden, but they have struggled to find a human as popular as the wish. In some respects, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. looks just like what people are longing for. He rejects both parties, and he claims to want to break the stranglehold of government bureaucracy, the cult of experts, and the outsized power of corporate interests. But while the wish is for a passionate centrist independent of the extremes, Kennedy in reality is a crank who attempts to transcend left and right by peddling a dog's breakfast of conspiratorialism from across the ideological spectrum. Long before Trump, RFK Jr. was the original election denier, insisting that Republicans stole the 2004 election. Before COVID-19, Kennedy was already famous for falsely claiming that all vaccines are dangerous and that some cause autism. He also stands by his claim that cell phones and Wi-Fi cause cancer, despite the lack of evidence of an increase in cancer rates linked to those technologies. Kennedy's default position is that official explanations are suspect. It's as if his entire political persona were designed to monetize what the political historian Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style in American politics. It's a testament to the pervasiveness of the paranoid style that it's difficult to figure out which party Kennedy will take more votes from. Hofstadter also said third parties are like bees. Once they have stung, they die, and the party they sting is the one they are closest to. As of now, it looks like Kennedy wants to sting leftward at Biden. His choice of Nicole Shanahan, a progressive young Asian American, California-based tech lawyer, as his running mate is one indication. Another, Timothy Mellon, the biggest donor to Kennedy's super PAC, is also the biggest donor to Trump's. In Jacob's story, spoiler alert, the protagonist uses the monkey's paw to wish for 200 pounds to pay off his mortgage. The next day, he learns that his son was fatally mangled in an industrial accident and receives a bereavement payment in that amount. After the funeral, the grieving father wishes his son brought back to life. Excuse me, I've lost my place. Give me a second here. There we go. After the funeral, the grieving father wishes his son brought back to life, but as he hears a knock at the door, he realizes that the fulfillment of his wish would be a disfigured abomination, and panicked, makes his last wish. When he opens the door, no one's there. If you've ever fondly wished for deliverance from our two-party system, the man you hear knocking is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And that, again, was from Jonah Goldberg, who is editor-in-chief of The Dispatch. And we've got enough time for some sports. So I'm going to turn to the sports section and read what we have on the air today. In college baseball, at 6 o'clock on ACCN, we have North Carolina at Virginia. Also at 6 p.m. on ESPN2, we have Vanderbilt at LSU. And at 6 o'clock, Mississippi at Arkansas on SECN. That was college baseball. College basketball at 8 o'clock on ESPN. There's the Final Four Slam Dunk and three-point championships. In college men's basketball at 6 o'clock, it's the NIT Championship, Indiana State versus Seton Hall on ESPN. In golf today at 12:30, you can catch the Augusta National Women's Amateur Second Round on the Golf Channel. At 3 o'clock, the PGA Tour Valero Texas Open First Round, also the Golf Channel. And at 6 o'clock this evening, the LPGA Tour T-Mobile Match Play Day 2 on the Golf Network. In Major League Baseball, at 3 o'clock today, Miami is at St. Louis. That's on the Bally M Channel. At 3 o'clock also, regional coverage on the MLBN Network. At 6:30 this evening, Chicago White Sox at Kansas City on NBCS-C and the MLBN Network. In the NBA at 6:30, we have Sacramento at New York on TNT and True TV. And at 9 p.m., Denver at the LA Clippers, also TNT and True TV. And finally, in men's soccer at 2:15 today, Premier League, Manchester United at Chelsea on USA Channel. Oh, excuse me. And also in tennis at 5 o'clock on the Tennis Channel, you can catch WTA Charleston Early Rounds. Now, from the wire. In the NFL, the Bills sending Diggs to Texans. The Buffalo Bills have agreed to trade their top receiving threat, Stephon Diggs, to the Houston Texans. The Bills acquired the Texans' second-round pick in the 2025 draft, which Houston acquired in a trade with Minnesota. Houston also acquired Buffalo's sixth-round pick in this year's draft and fifth-rounder in 2025. Diggs' departure from Buffalo leaves a quarterback, Josh Allen, without his favorite target and breaks up a tandem that has rewritten the team's passing records since the receiver's arrival in a trade with Minnesota in March of 2020. For the Texans, Diggs gives the offense another playmaker to team with Nico Collins and Tank Dell. In college basketball, LSU star Reese headed to the WNBA. LSU star Angel Reese formally declared for the WNBA draft less than 2 days after the Tigers' season ended with a loss to Caitlin Clark and Iowa in the Elite Eight round of the women's NCAA tournament. Reese made her announcement via a photo shoot in Vogue, saying she was inspired by tennis great Serena Williams, retiring in similar fashion in 2022. Reese acknowledges having made her decision to turn pro before March Madness began. She says, "I like to do everything big," and adds, "I didn't want anything to be basic." We have in golf, Kim takes lead in match play out of North Las Vegas, Nevada. Say Young Kim shot a 6-under 66 in the opening round of the T-Mobile Match Play LPGA event Wednesday. Las Vegas area residents Danielle Kang and Rose Zhang were each just a stroke behind. Top-ranked Nelly Korda has some work to do to extend her three-tournament winning streak after shooting a 73. Lorena Ochoa in 2008 was the last LPGA Tour player to win four in a row. The top 65 players, plus ties after the first 2 days, will advance to the third round Friday, and then the top eight players will compete in match play over the weekend. In soccer, Out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Lionel Messi was not suited up for Inter Miami's game against Mexico's Monterrey in the CONCACAF Championship Cup quarterfinal first leg. That's CONCACAF. Messi, who is dealing with a right hamstring injury, has not played for Miami since March 13th when he left a 3-1 win over Nashville just a few minutes into the second half because of discomfort in his right hamstring. The 36-year-old also missed Argentina's exhibitions this month against El Salvador and Costa Rica. The second leg of the quarterfinal will be played April 10th in Mexico. And in horse racing, the Baffert bill prompts a lawsuit. The owner of Arkansas Derby winner Muth has sued Churchill Downs and is seeking a temporary injunction against what it called the track's illegal ban of Hall of Fame trainer Bob Baffert that keeps the colt he trained from competing in next month's 150th Kentucky Derby. Baffert is suspended through the end of 2024 for a positive drug test by Medina Spirit after finishing first in the 2021 Derby. ZRS founder Amir Zidane filed the lawsuit in circuit court and suggested a vendetta by CDI CEO Bill Carstensen. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Dorothy Hockenberg. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.